Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm senior producer Connor Boyle. On today's podcast, Michael Lewis, the journalist and best-selling author of non-fiction hits that have also gone on to become Hollywood box office favorites, such as Moneyball and The Big Short, joins us to discuss his latest, Going Infinite, The Rise and Fall of a New Tycoon. Lewis's latest book tells the story of crypto entrepreneur Sam Bankman-Fried, who's currently on trial for a litany of financial offenses following the collapse of his multi-billion dollar crypto outfit, FTX. Lewis had a front row seat to all of the action, having trailed Bankman-Fried for many of the months leading up to his arrest in late 2022. He's in conversation in this episode with journalist, presenter and broadcaster Riddle Shah, and this was a live event which took place just a few weeks ago at London's Union Chapel. Today's episode is the first of three parts, and if you can't wait for the second half, just become a member of Intelligence Squared at intelligencesquared.com/membership or hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts to get access to parts 1, 2 and the exclusive members only part 3 as well. Now let's join Riddle Shah with more.
Hello everyone. Tinker, tailor, soldier, sailor, rich man, poor man, beggar man, thief. I was thinking about that nursery rhyme today as I tried to weigh up my opinion of Sam Bankman-Fried, the man who became a crypto billionaire before his 30th birthday, vowed to give it all away, and is now standing trial for fraud and conspiracy in a Manhattan court. Original or reckless, brilliant, or just a charlatan, it's possible to attach any number of conflicting adjectives to Bankman-Fried's and his extraordinary story and his meteoric rise and failure. Luckily for us, we have an author on stage who's written a huge number of bestsellers on some of the biggest stories of our time and has watched the story of Sam Bankman-Fried unfold from the inside. Michael Lewis's books include Flash Boys, Liar's Poker, The Big Short and Moneyball, both made into successful movies. And his new book is Going Infinite, The Rise and Fall of a New Tycoon. It is his compelling take on the story of Sam Bankman-Fried. Now, before we begin, a quick explanation for all of you. We're going to have a chat first on the stage, Michael and I. There will be time for all of you to ask questions. There'll be a roving mic down here. I'll ask you to stand up and ask your question. There are two fixed mics up there on either side in the hall. If you're watching online, then please submit your questions in the box, and we'd love to hear from you. I will make sure there's lots of time for questions at the end. So let's begin. Michael Lewis, welcome, first of all. I want to begin really simply by asking how you came to meet Sam Bankman-Fried. How did you get involved in all of this?
So a lot of my books start accidentally, and this was no exception. September of 2021, I had a call from a friend and former book subject, the main character of Flash Boys, asking me if I would meet with this person who he was about to do a business deal with. The person was Sam Bankman-Fried. I'd never heard of him. He said he was about to swap shares in his company for shares in Sam Bankman-Fried's company, FTX, which I'd never heard of. And he said, it's such an odd situation for me because it's a big deal. This company, FTX, is the fastest growing financial business I've ever seen. Everybody in our inner circle is sort of on board, but it's very hard for us to get a read on who he is. He says, I met with him, I don't have a good feel. He was the richest person in the world under 30 at that point. And he said, I called all over Wall Street and nobody knows who he is. So I said, sure. And Sam Bankman-Fried happened to have grown up in the Bay Area where I live and he was visiting his parents and he came over to see me. That had been maybe a month later. And he tumbles out of an Uber. He looks like he tumbled out of a dumpster. He's wearing his shorts and his T-shirt. He's always dressed for a hike, but I think I was the first one I ever took him on one. And so we went on the walk in the Berkeley Hills. And after about an hour, I had ceased to really think very much about my friend's interest and started to think about my own. Because he was, the things that were coming out of his mouth, both how fast he had made it, how the world had responded. I mean, he was at that point, he was saying $22.5 billion. How the world was configuring itself around his money, what he intended to do with the money. At the end of the walk, I just said, I don't know where this is all going to end up, but could I just watch?
And so you were impressed.
There's a backstory to this. I had decided some years ago, and the last book I wrote, The Premonition, was the one result of this, that I was going to start books with a character, I was going to let the story take care of itself. So what I thought after 2 hours with him is this is a character. I don't know where it goes or what it is, but it was so odd. It was peculiar. And the first thing I said, it was months before I called up a publisher and said, maybe I've got a book here. And what I said to them, I can remember what I said. I don't know, I still didn't know what the story was, but it was, there's a Sam Bankman-Fried shaped hole in the world now that I did not know exist. I want to use him to describe that hole. And so I thought he could take me places. And in particular, so from that walk, the places I thought he could take me, I was really interested that he was a spawn of Wall Street, that especially very modern Wall Street, high frequency trading, had given him his identity. I thought it's a way into that story. Like, what is going on in markets there? He could take me there. He could take me into American politics because he was threatening to spend $1 billion in the next presidential election, and he was already had already become Biden's second biggest donor, and was meddling in all kinds of interesting ways in congressional races. I thought he could take me into crypto. Crypto was on a list of things I was interested in. I had not been that interested in it as. Crypto people had called me over the years, write about us, because they were always promoting themselves. He was interesting, because he was the first crypto person in crypto I'd met who didn't care all that much about crypto.
Right.
He was agnostic. Mostly they're religionists. He had the view that this could all be BS, it could all fall apart. So I was thinking, like, where he takes me. And now he ended up taking me a lot, many further places than I imagined he was going to take me.
And that journey may still be continuing, but let's pick up on a couple of things you mentioned there. So his background, his parents are academics. You talked about the fact that he was giving money away. So it was at university that he became interested in this thing called effective altruism. Just tell us a little bit about this. It's a proper kind of ideology that he got.
You people are responsible for this. It comes out of Oxford, right? As I understood it, so he had no particular direction in life. He was a son, child of two Stanford law professors and had kind of always assumed he would be a professor of some sort. Given his abilities, he would have been maybe a physics or a math teacher, but actually wasn't all that interested in it. Two things happen to him in university that give him direction. One is he collides with these high-frequency traders who discover a curious aptitude in him, and we can talk about what that is, because it is a curious aptitude. But he also collides with effective altruism, which is young then. It's 2012. This is a movement that grows out of utilitarianism. The greatest good for the greatest number. But there's a philosopher at Oxford named Toby Ord who gets the movement going by making the point that at very little inconvenience to himself, if he directs the money he gives away really smartly, effectively, that he can do enormous good. And he writes a paper where he shows that if he gives away half his salary over his lifetime, he will spare 80,000 African children of blindness. And the movement actually kind of actively starts to recruit. And it finds the people most interested in the movement in kind of math and physics programs, mainly at American universities, at elite American universities. And one of the movement's founders, a fellow named Will McGaskill, well-known, gives a talk in Cambridge that Sam hears. And the important parts of the talk are, at that point, Sam knew about effective altruism. and was interested in its ideas. But effective altruism had spawned another idea, and it was earned to give. And this is what Sam hears Will McGaskill basically talk about. And it's as you, 20-year-old college student who doesn't know what you want to do with your life, think about what you want to do with your life. Consider this choice. Let's make this choice explicit. You could go become a doctor and go work in Africa and save so many lives. Or if you have this aptitude that Wall Street craves, you could go to Wall Street and you could make money enough to send 20 doctors to Africa and save 20 times as many lives. Now, what's happening here is your life choices are being turned into a math problem. And Sam responded powerfully to this. And it was this earn to give idea. Okay, I'm going to go figure out how to make as much money as possible. And essentially divorce. It's not going to be a matter of the heart. I'm not doing this because I'm feeling a certain that this is my way of having the most impact on the world. And this is the beginning of Sam Bankman-Fried as a character in the world. That he at this virtually the same time, without having it, I mean, this is not a person who is a money person. He does not grow up with like, and never really becomes someone who has much interest in material things. And his parents don't either, kind of lives in his head, that the idea that it bewildered the parents, that all of a sudden the child is being recruited by Wall Street firms, and that there's this thing he can do, and they've discovered he can do, and it pays not just a few million dollars, it might pay many, 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 many millions of dollars.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
So we'll come back to the money aspect a bit later, but just talk about that aptitude. So what is it about Sam Bankman-Fried that made him so good at high-frequency trading when he joined a Wall Street firm?
So when I went through Wall Street interviews back in the 1980s, they were their own strange event, mainly designed to sort of test your nerve. Mm. I mean, they do just weird things like... generally, what they were trying to do is make you as uncomfortable as possible and see how you responded. And the interviews that identify Sam Bankman-Fried as possibly very gifted in a way that the high-frequency traders care about, and these are the firms, by the way, these firms, I mean, unless you're in Wall Street or in finance, you may never have heard of these places.
Well, Jane Street.
Jane Street, I'd never Jump heard of Trading, it until... Tower Research, Susquehanna Capital, Citadel, Virtu. These are the names of the places. And this is a phenomenon of the last 15 years. They are taking the interesting risk in the markets now. It's no longer Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley that are doing this. These firms, they are the ones who are establishing market prices. And in these places, sums of money are being made that dwarf the sums of money that were made in their predecessors. I mean, it used to be a big deal to make $1 million in a firm. There are people in these firms who make billions of dollars. And the tests they put you through and the kind of people they're looking for are a little different. Social skills, not important, not at all important. What's important is it's a mathiness, but it's not just a mathiness. It's a mathiness combined with an ability to deal with messiness. So it's Sam Bankman-Fried, good at chess, good at math camp, but not the very best. Not going to be a famous mathematician, not going to be a chess champion. But if instead you change chess so that every move has to be done within 10 seconds and every 2 minutes, some voice shouts a rule change, so queens become pawns, or pawns can fly, or whatever it is, it doesn't matter. Creating a kind of semi-chaotic environment, that's the environment that at least the people who are recruiting for these firms think you need to be good at in order to thrive.
And he also appears to be willing to take risks. Where other people might hesitate, he jumps in.
Correct. But you have to be able to make decisions where other people might be paralyzed. And he would say, and I think this is true, that the kind of problems they give you tend to cause people just to not make decisions. And they're looking for people who will make decisions and make them fairly quickly. His willingness to make the decisions was an asset in this process. We don't want to run through any of these tests. They're incredibly arcane, what they do to these people. And you look and you say, like, how do you even think about that problem? For example, to reduce to a quantitative matter, what's the likelihood that I have a relative who played professional baseball? And to think through that problem in a really sophisticated way and do it quickly. It's one of the tests they put him through. And another way of thinking about what they do is learning how to quantify things that you might think are of as qualitative matters or qualitative decisions. He had the ability to do that. He off the charts ability. Like when he went through these interviews, one of the firms stopped the interviews halfway through the interviews and said, "We don't need to do any more. You just outscored anybody this year." And his problem, however, is that these tests, and the problem these firms have, I think, is these tests do not filter for any kind of social ability. And this is a person who, to describe him as isolated, doesn't fully capture the nature of the person. This is a person who, from a very early age, so when I ask him, I would do with any subject, give me a list of people who knew you before the age of 18, so I can just get a sense of what your childhood was like. He couldn't name a person. His parents, his brother was off the list because his brother, he didn't have anything to do with his brother. And I had to kind of dig and dig and dig to find people who had interaction with him before the age of 18. He felt, first, no real feeling for people. Like in the presence of people, he didn't feel love. He said, I didn't feel pride. I didn't feel any of the things people normally feel. He said, the thing I most weirdly couldn't do is I couldn't make facial expressions. So when people were interacting with me, I wasn't giving, they didn't know how to respond to me. So they just thought I was this weird thing. So
Say, he does at one time though, talks about being depressed. And I wonder if that reflects the fact that he does feel emotion, but just perhaps not in the way that you or I might.
I'm sure he feels something. His self-identity was, I don't understand these feelings. I don't have these feelings. And he was ostracized all the way through childhood. Less so at MIT, because MIT tends to collect these people who are ostracized by everybody else when they're in high school. But he was...
Some recognition there in the audience.
He was the kind of person who even the nerds rejected because he was such a nerd, right? There was no spot for this in a private Silicon Valley high school where his classmate is Steve Jobs' son, that you would think there'd be plenty of people who he could not relate to, who could not relate to him, and they would bond over that.
But
that's not what happened.
I wonder, though, if it develops later on, just jumping forward for a moment, into a kind of arrogance, because he tells you at one point that he doesn't struggle to read other people. His problem is that people can't read him. And there's a little bit of me that thinks, come on.
He was pretty good at reading other people. I think he was surprised. This is the part that doesn't fit the overall picture, that his astuteness about other people, not always, but better than you would have imagined, given how. And the point about other people reading him is, if he's not giving anything, it's hard, right? Yeah. When he is in college, when he starts to develop ambition to go to work on Wall Street, and he realizes that there's been no social filter, but eventually there's going to be problems because he can't do the social thing, he gets a mirror and he starts practicing like how to smile. And he's resentful about it. Why do I need to grin when you say something that's amusing? Isn't it enough that I just listen? But he forces himself to learn these things. So you say arrogance. I agree. It's the arrogance of a boy who sits in a room thinking about the world and watching the world for 18 years and trying to position himself in a way that is not completely defeating in relation to that world. And he had a hollow sense of his own superiority without anything really, up to the point he hits Wall Street, with any kind of evidence to suggest he is superior in any way. He was never thought extremely special until he hits Wall Street.
So he's successful at Jane Street, successful trader, but then sees a gap in the market and decides to leave and create his own firm, Alameda Research.
Can we do one thing before we move
on
from Wall Street?
On.
I don't want to interrupt your interview.
No, it's fine.
But this is something. This never will get mentioned in the press. So what they did in this firm is two chapters of the book are just about this, and it's riveting what's going on in this place. And I'm going to give one example. Sam Bankman-Fried and a few colleagues before the presidential election 2016.
It's a great example.
It's crazy stuff, right? But this will give you whet your appetite. Mm. Although you're all getting the book anyway, so I don't really need to do that. So before the Clinton-Trump before the election, everybody notices, like everybody in the financial markets notices, that whenever there's good news for Trump, the stock markets collapse. And whenever there's good news for Clinton, the stock markets go up. And they think to themselves, we wonder if we can get information, real-time information, on election night before anybody else in the world and trade on it, because it's obviously going to move markets around. And this is audacious. If you ask what Sam Bankman-Fried and these firms are doing, what they're generally, they're looking to get information no one else has before anybody has it and put it in the markets, but on the level of the second or the millisecond. Mm. And so they build a data collection machine where traders are assigned to states in the United States to find better, faster ways to get the information from the polls. And you would think, well, how could they do that? But the way up to that point, Americans are getting the results of their election is on cable news. And the cable, it goes to commercials. The guy has to walk across a set to his map. There are all these human things that are slowing down the information arriving in the minds of Wall Street people. And they indeed build this thing that enables them to have sometimes minutes, sometimes hours advantages on the market about what's happening in this election. And Sam is right in the middle of this. This is the sort of thing that completely captivates him. They make a bet. The bet is that as they see that Trump is going to win, that U.S. stock markets are going to collapse. They bet the foreign stock markets are going to collapse too, but they make their big bet in the U.S. stock markets. That's what they do in the first 4 or 5 hours. After 5 hours after the election, they have the most profitable trade in the history of Jane Street. They've made several $100 million in a matter of hours. Sam goes to bed for a few hours and comes back, and it's the worst trade in the history of Jane Street because markets have rallied. The U.S. markets have rallied on the news of Trump, and they've lost all this money. What happens next tells you something about Sam Bankman-Fried. He's lost. He's just orchestrated the worst trade in the history of this firm. The firm, the way they think about things, they don't blame him. The process was fine. Everybody approved of it. They don't look to scapegoat him. They just say, like, we won't do this again. Mm. One of the reasons Sam Bankman-Fried leaves Jane Street is he's upset they won't do this again. He says the problem wasn't that we shouldn't have done this. It's just we should have thought about it a little better, how we traded it. We should keep doing this. And he found their lack of ambition frustrating. So it's an amazing thing. So then he finds crypto.
Okay, you're so Alameda right. Research, and I'm going to spool forward a little bit.
Right.
He gets funding from Effective Altruists, partly to help Alameda Research do its work. Is that right?
Yep.
But there is, at some point, a schism, right?
Well, this is a foreshadowing of what is going to happen.
$4 billion goes missing, and a whole bunch of people...
No, $4 million.
$4 million.
But $4 million in a pile.
$4 million, I apologize. $4 million goes missing. And a bunch of people choose to leave. Should alarm bells have rung in many people's minds at that moment about Sam Bankman-Fried?
And they did. So what happens is he's going to be the first high-frequency trader into crypto, basically, is the idea. He moves to California at the end of 2017, and for various reasons, only recruits other effective altruists to work in this hedge fund. Only a couple of whom had any real financial experience. Mm. So there are 20 or so of them. And within months, the firm is in a civil war because half the firm thinks Sam is either a crook or so catastrophically sloppy that he might as well be a crook. And they're missing money, like literally don't know where it is. And money that has come to them from effective altruists. So they're thinking, this money could have gone to save lives in Africa. Instead, it's gone to fuel Sam Bankman-Fried's mad trading, and now we don't know where it is, and Sam doesn't care to go find it. He wants to just keep trading because he thinks he'll turn up anyway. So it did set off alarm bells in the effective altruist community, because they were the only ones privy to what was going on. Half the people quit the firm, including the entire management committee apart from Sam, and they find the money. So then it gets very complicated because they've accused him of stealing the money, they've accused him of losing the money, and that, actually the money's there. And actually these things he wants to do make sense, and he starts to make a lot of money. And I caught the effective altruist who had left and had accused him of wrongdoing in the moment when things were going great for Sam Bankman-Fried, and all but one of them were sheepish and apologetic, like we should never have left, we should have trusted him.
That's
But they were all having second thoughts about the schism. But the schism actually is a foreshadowing of what's going to happen, because the carelessness was breathtaking. And the willingness to take risk was breathtaking. And also the willingness to do things without consulting anybody. Like, they got to a point in this firm where it was so scary that all this money was missing, his fellow managers would make Sam promise, you can't hit the button and send your bots out there to make 250,000 trades a day unless we're here with you to watch. And he goes, yeah, okay. And then they go home for the night, he hits the button and falls asleep. And that was a kind of common occurrence. So it was a obvious recklessness that gets buried. It gets buried. That all the people who were suspicious of him but one, there was an exception in the management ranks, and end up like rethinking their suspicions and thinking, no, he was actually very special, and we should have appreciated how special he was.
And the people that remain, to some extent, are true believers. Two of them.
Well, this shapes the firm, right?
So you've got two of them who are in court this week: Gary Wang, the coder, and Caroline Ellison. I mean, just two of the characters that appear in the book that are still part of the story. How much do you think Sam Bankman-Fried was able to behave in the way that he did, to go on to create FTX, which appeared to be a company without any controls, without any of the normal structures you'd expect in a company of that size?
Can we talk a little bit about that? About just how peculiar this was?
I mean, it's extraordinary. Yes, please do.
Let me give one example, and then to illustrate the general chaos. So does anybody have the book on them right now? If you open the book, and could you hand us the cover, just the jacket cover, and do you mind if I?
No, not
okay.
At all.
So let me do that. I can get up and do this. I mean, probably this is breaking protocol with the Intelligence Squared. Standing up. So, but I'm going to show you. I want to show you something, because this really does kind of dramatize it. So when the whole thing falls apart. So when Sam Bankman-Fried, he had a principled objection to job titles and organization charts, and even having a list of the employees who worked in the firm, or anybody knowing the list of employees who worked in the firm. And he saw the organization chart, people see where they are, and it distorts their behavior towards each other. He had a long, this is all in the story, he had a long explanation for why he wouldn't do conventional organization. Of course, people need organization. And especially half his firm is Chinese, and they just go insane without an organization chart. Like it's the most important thing in a Chinese firm. And so Sam would subcontract all the dealing with the other people's emotions and unhappiness to other people in the firm. One of the people to whom he subcontracts a large part of this mess is his own psychiatrist, who he has flown from San Francisco, who has gone from San Francisco where he was psychiatrist to effective altruist. That was his business, basically. Mm. And so he's got a wonderful view on the whole effective altruist thing. He comes to the Bahamas, where he, within moments, has 100 FTX employees on his couch coming through to talk about their personal problems. And the personal problems are, because all they do is work, are all job problems. And the job problems are mostly like, I don't know where I am in this organization. I hate my boss, but I don't know who my boss is. It's that kind of stuff. And so the psychiatrist, in order to treat these people, starts to, in therapy, ask them, who's above them, who's below them, who do they report to, who do they talk to? And he creates an organization chart, but tells zero people except me. Sam Bankman-Fried is in jail, so he does not know this exists. He'd be outraged to know this exists. But the prosecutors don't know this exists. The bankruptcy people have said over and over, we don't know who even worked for this firm. Well, here they are, every single name, and it's beautifully done. So I don't mean to screw up your book cover. We'll get it back, but we'll sign your book twice. But you look at it, and it's like one of those family trees in a Tolstoy novel. This will help you understand everything you read, and there are things on it that are just beautiful. I mean, someone who's actually a business consultant would take this and say, "Wait, 24 people are reporting to Sam. How does that work?" And he won't talk to any of them. But Gary Wang, who doesn't speak except when he's on a witness stand, Gary Wang, who is the CTO, who cooks up this business with Sam, who is meant to chief technology officer in a basically technology firm. He has no one underneath him. And that's because the therapist didn't know business, but he knew that Gary didn't talk to anybody, so there must be no one underneath him. Anyway, let's give this back to you now. There we go. But that's an example, just a little example of how this place functioned, and it was so wonderful. For a writer's point of view, I wouldn't invest in it, but from a writer's point of view, it was just delightful because you'd never seen anything like it.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Hannah Kay and edited by Tom Paul. Don't forget, there's more of that discussion to dig into for Intelligence Squared members. Part 2 and 3 are ready for them right now. You can become a member by hitting the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts or signing up on the Intelligence Squared website. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared.